Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Angola's new president, João Lourenço, has been in the news since taking office 4 months ago. Lourenço has made a number of moves, such as dismissing high-level officials. He says the moves are part of his campaign promise to fight corruption and rebuild the country's economy. In December, he removed Isabel dos Santos, a daughter of former President José Eduardo dos Santos, from her job as head of Angola's oil company. Earlier this month, the new president ousted José Filomeno dos Santos, the son of the former president, as head of the nation's $5 billion sovereign wealth fund. The program is meant to support growth, economic conditions, and social development across the country. Angola watchers say Lourenço's actions are meant to fuel an economy that has long depended on oil exports and foreign investment. Alex Vines works for the London-based Chatham House Research Group. He says the president has earned a nickname by dismissing top officials. Vines likens him to the Terminator, the killer cyborg played by Arnold Schwarzenegger in the 1984 film. The Dos Santos family expected change after Lourenço became president, Vines told VOA. What none of the family, I think, recognized was that change would come so quickly, he said. Vines thinks that has to do with the fact that Angola could not support the sort of business model that happened in the last years of the Dos Santos presidency.
They've been removed out of their positions much more quickly than anybody would have imagined, hence the nickname for João Lourenço in Angola now, which is the Terminator.
Paula Roque, another Angola watcher, is based in Johannesburg, South Africa. Unlike others, she is not yet willing to give the new president too much credit as a reformer. She told VOA, "The dismissals are important, but he had to do it."
You can't run the country, you certainly can't reform an economy without taking the levers of control of the revenues. And the oil company was certainly one of them. The sovereign wealth fund was created for rainy days, and Angola is certainly going through a crisis. So he really didn't have much of an option but to do what he did.
But the changes are far from a complete ouster of the country's top leadership. Observers and anti-corruption groups have estimated that the Dos Santos family still controls billions of dollars worth of government resources. Paula Roque said that in reality, Isabel still controls the diamond industry in Angola.
So it goes much deeper than just having key positions that we know of. We're talking about holding companies, shell companies. We're talking about the use of state resources to invest in private enterprises.
Rafael Marques de Moraes is an Angolan-based anti-corruption campaigner. He believes Lourenço's moves only serve to direct attention away from his lack of an economic plan. The president's children were only the tip of the iceberg, and he only dealt with the tip of the iceberg, he told VOA from Luanda, Angola's capital. And now people are realizing he has not terminated the iceberg, but just broke some ice. I think at this point that people are realizing that this is just a show because he doesn't have a clear economic policy. Economists have, however, praised the government's recent moves, like the announcement last week that Angola would repay its $5 billion debt by 2019. But Lourenço has also been criticized by anti-corruption activists for defending the nation's former vice president. Manuel Vicente is accused of offering money to a Portuguese judge when he served as head of Angola's state-operated oil company. Angola gained independence from Portugal in 1975. Vicente's corruption trial began this week in Lisbon. Portuguese officials have refused to move the case to Angola. The officials have said they don't believe he will be fully investigated if he comes back home.
The American company Amazon has launched a store that does not require you to stand in a checkout line or someone to process your payment. You simply need an app on a mobile device, such as a smartphone. People with the app can enter the store, choose the products they want, and then leave the store with them. The company opened its first Amazon Go store this week in the state of Washington, after more than a year of testing. You first need to download the Amazon Go app, a computer program that helps you gain entry to the store. Once inside, hundreds of cameras and electronic sensors follow people's movements and record all the products chosen. The products are then placed in the app's virtual shopping cart. In other words, the app remembers everything chosen by the customer. If you decide against buying one or more products before leaving the store, the software automatically removes those items from its memory. The system is powered by artificial intelligence, or AI, technology. At the end of the visit, the customer just walks out of the store with all the desired products. Payment is made automatically through the app, which is linked to the buyer's credit card. The first Amazon Go is a small food market, selling mainly ready-to-eat products and drinks. It sits on the first floor of Amazon's headquarters in Seattle. "It's such a weird experience," shopper Lisa Doyle told the Associated Press after trying out the new store. "Because you feel like you're stealing when you go out the door." Another visitor, Paul Fan, said he tested the technology by turning off his smartphone, taking some products, and then putting them where they did not belong. He said the app was not fooled and still recognized all the correct items. Peter Gray told the Associated Press he usually makes purchases online to avoid store crowds. Gray said he was pleased with the new shopping experience. "Just being able to walk out and not interact with anyone was amazing," he said. Even though there is no need for cashiers to take payments, Amazon Go does employ workers. Some prepare food, while others refill product supplies and assist customers. Gianna Perini is vice president of Amazon Go. She told Reuters it is the first time this kind of computer technology has been used in a store setting. If you look at these products, you can see they're super similar, she said, of two nearly exact Starbucks coffee drinks sitting next to each other. One had light cream added, while the other was coffee with no cream or sugar. But the technology learned to tell them apart. Amazon has yet to announce plans for additional Go stores. Last year, the online marketer bought U.S.-based Whole Foods Market, giving the company 470 stores. But Amazon said it has no immediate plans to add the same technology to the larger and more complex Whole Foods markets. Other companies are also working to create artificial intelligence-powered stores. One of them is Standard Cognition, a startup company in California. The company has developed technology that works like that of Amazon Go. It uses machine vision cameras to follow customers' movements. The goal is the same: to let shoppers walk into a store, choose desired goods, and leave without going through a checkout line. But Standard Cognition seeks to sell its artificial intelligence system to businesses for use in their own stores. iPolly is another California startup developing camera-powered computer vision technology. iPolly's website says its products can create fully autonomous markets. The system combines the understanding of human activity in real time with the movement and interaction of objects, the site said. In addition to providing customers a checkout-free experience, the technology can also follow the movement of all company products. iPolly says the AI data can help businesses, both big and small, continuously follow their full inventory of products. Another company has taken the self-service shopping idea one step further by making the stores autonomous and movable. Wheelies, a Swedish company, sells movable coffee stands worldwide. It also invented Mobi Mart, a small market on wheels. The AI-powered Mobi Mart is about the size of a small bus. It offers products found in 24-hour markets, such as milk, fruits, and medicine. People gain entry to the store through an app. It also uses cameras to observe the movements of people and products. The developers say they created Mobi Mart to be a self-driving vehicle that can be called to certain areas through an app. The vehicle has its own solar panels to power the electrical engine. The service has already been tested in China, and the company says on its website it plans to launch Mobi 2 sometime in 2018. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time on our program, we talked about the election of 1840. William Henry Harrison easily defeated Martin Van Buren and became the 9th President of the United States. By that time, another political force was growing in the country. It did not come from Van Buren's Democratic Party, nor did it come from Harrison's Whig Party. It grew out of slavery. The dispute over slavery appeared to have been resolved for a time. A political compromise in 1820 kept a balance between slave and non-slave states. The compromise also barred slavery in the northern part of the Louisiana Purchase. But during the 1830s, the issue of slavery rose to the surface again. A major reason why the dispute came to life again was cotton. Cotton plants grew in many fields across the southern states. Black slaves planted, picked, and took care of the cotton crops. They also had other duties on southern farms. Northern ships then carried southern cotton to the markets of Europe. Manufactured goods needed in the South came from the North. The situation deeply troubled the political leaders of the South. They worried that cotton made their states economically dependent on the industrial North. What made things worse was the fact that most federal spending on public works projects went to the northern states. Then there was the old dispute over import taxes. Taxes on foreign goods mostly helped the manufacturers of the North. The taxes were to be lowered in 1842, but that was still years away. No one could be sure what would happen then. Such were the general political and economic conditions in the United States when the abolitionist movement began to make itself known. Abolitionism was an effort to end slavery and the slave trade. At first, religious groups organized the abolitionist movement. Then, in the 1830s, anti-slavery societies began operating in New York and New England. Many abolitionist groups published newspapers, pamphlets, and booklets. They flooded the country with anti-slavery petitions. Abolitionists believed slavery was evil and that there could be no compromise with evil. They did not like the idea that slaves should become free slowly over time, and they did not think slaveholders should be paid to free their slaves. They just wanted all slavery to disappear immediately.
They were regarded as this wild-eyed, fanatic group on the far left inside of the anti-slavery movement. People who were willing to do anything, radicals, they would upend society. This was the view that the people had of them.
Howard Jones is an historian. For many years, he taught at the University of Alabama. He says the abolitionists did not have much popular support. In the South, slavery was not a question of right or wrong. It was a question of survival. Some Southerners believed that without slavery, their whole economic system would lie in ruins. In the North, the abolitionists did not yet have major support. Some feared the abolitionist movement would weaken the rule of law. Even if they did not like slavery, these people believed the Constitution permitted it. As a result of the public feeling at the time, abolitionists struggled to communicate their message. Some states even sought to stop the flow of anti-slavery literature across their borders. In 1836, the House of Representatives declared it would not listen to any anti-slavery petitions. This decision became known as the gag rule. The Senate did not pass such a rule, but it did develop a complex, indirect method to delay action on anti-slavery petitions. Then something strange happened. Historian Howard Jones says some abolitionists believed the event was God's way of helping their cause. In August of 1839, a slave ship appeared in waters off the coast of New York. The ship was carrying two white Spanish-speaking men and about 50 men, women, and children from Africa. The captain was missing. American sailors stopped the ship and brought everyone to the mainland. No one knew what to do with the Africans. Were they criminals? Slaves? If so, who did they belong to? The Africans did not speak English or Spanish, so they could not explain themselves. The government jailed the Africans in New Haven, Connecticut, while officials tried to decide what to do. The slave ship was called the Amistad, and the case became known as the Amistad case. One of the leaders of the abolitionist movement, a man named Lewis Tappan, was very wealthy. Howard Jones says that Mr. Tappan sought to use the Amistad case to gain support for ending slavery.
What Tappan wanted to do was to use his almost unlimited financial resources to take these people to court, the Amistad captives, 53 of them, and show that they were human beings, that they had a right to be free.
The abolitionists found a free black man who spoke both English and Mende, the language of a few of the Africans. This translator helped explain what happened. The Mende said they had been kidnapped from their homes in West Africa. They were forced to march to the coast. There, white slave traders bought them. At that time, the United States, Spain, and many other countries had signed treaties to ban the international slave trade. The United States had also made buying slaves from Africa illegal, but the government did not enforce the law. A Portuguese ship brought the Mende and several hundred other captured Africans to Cuba. Many died of sickness, starvation, or beatings on the long trip across the Atlantic Ocean, which was called the Middle Passage. Those who survived were brought to a market in Havana. Cuba was a Spanish colony at the time. Spanish law said slavery was legal on the island, but the slave trade was not. To get around the law, many traders acted as if captured Africans had been living in Cuba as slaves for a long time. For instance, one of the young Mende men was named Sengbe Pie. Two Cuban middlemen bought him and about 50 other men, women, and children for farms on the other side of the island. The middlemen wrote his name in their records as Joseph Sinque. They gave the other Africans Spanish names too, so it would seem like the Africans had been born in Cuba. Then they loaded the group onto a ship called the Amistad, a name that means friendship in Spanish, and chained them below deck. Historian Howard Jones says the Amistad was like a taxi.
It would transport slaves wherever you wanted them to be taken. Now, they weren't really slaves. They had never been enslaved, but they were called that at this point. That's a critical issue in this whole thing.
A few nights later, Sengbe Pie and some of the other Africans broke free. They found weapons and waited until sunrise. The next morning, Pie and his shipmates killed the captain of the Amistad and the cook. Two crew members escaped. The Cuban middlemen were the only white people who remained. The Africans said they would let the Cubans live, but only if they brought the ship back to Africa. The middlemen agreed. During the day, they sailed the Amistad southeast, but at night, they turned the ship northwest toward the United States, hoping to arrive one day in a friendly southern port. Nearly 2 months later, the food and water on the Amistad were gone. Several of the Africans took a small boat to land to get more supplies. The captain of a government ship saw them. He brought the Africans and the Amistad into port in the northern state of Connecticut. The Cuban middlemen told their side of the story. They said the Africans were slaves who had revolted and claimed the ship's passengers as property. The Spanish government agreed with the middlemen. It demanded that the ship and the Africans be returned to Cuba. Spain's queen said that Spanish law would decide what happened next. Martin Van Buren, who was president at the time, liked the Spanish idea. He did not want to cause problems with Southern voters and politicians. He wanted to avoid the issue. But it was too late. The captain of the government ship said the Amistad and the Africans on it belonged to him. He said he had found them and he had a right to sell the Africans as slaves. The captain gave the middlemen permission to go, and he gave the Africans to the U.S. government to decide the case. The charges against the Amistad Africans were serious. They were accused of being murderers and pirates. If they were found guilty, they could be enslaved for the rest of their lives or put to death. But the abolitionists claimed the Amistad Africans were something entirely different. They said the Africans were captives who had been kidnapped illegally. The Africans should not be punished, the abolitionists said, but returned to Africa. Historian Howard Jones says the abolitionists looked forward to presenting the case in court. They also hoped Sengbe Pie and the others could help with their communication problems. They wanted the Amistad Africans to tell Americans what life in Africa was like.
But more important than that, what it was like on the dread African slave trade, that middle passage, those thousands of miles of crossing the ocean to the New World, and then, by extension, throw a dark light on what slavery was like itself.
I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.